Tech Weekly is brought to you by Taylor Wessing, bringing you the latest on legal development in technology and media. For more information, head to guardian.co.uk/media-tech-law.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Jemima Kish, looking after things while Alex Kratosky is playing beach volleyball in Spain, the lucky girl. There's an international flavour to the programme this week. We'll start off by hearing from Yevgeny Morozov, the Stanford scholar who doubts whether the web can bring about democratic change. Despite reports noting the importance of Facebook in the current Tunisian protests and the 2009 Twitter revolution in Iran, Yevgeny thinks the new technology could end up causing many more problems than it solves. Charles finds out from this cyber skeptic that the everyday tools we use for shopping and personalization could end up restricting the internet in authoritarian states. Despite not actually being here, Alex has still been very busy speaking to Indian business blogger Nikhil Parwa from MediaNama.com. He's the first interviewee from her recent trip to the country and sets the scene, explaining what the digital sector is like in the country, what opportunities there are for British businesses in India, and how the mobile internet is the next big hope. We've also got this week's technology headlines, with news on Steve Jobs' latest health problems, a Facebook flotation that flopped, and how Nokia doesn't come with music anymore. So keep listening. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Following weeks of street protests, events over the last 7 days in Tunisia resulted in the overthrow of the government and have left former President Ben Ali in exile. The action was partly attributed to the coordination of the protesters using Facebook to exchange messages and has similar parallels to the protests in Iran 2 years ago, when the US State Department requested Twitter postpone some maintenance work so that it could stay online and enable communications during a critical period of unrest. But Belarusian-born Yevgeny Morozov is a visiting scholar at Stanford University and is much more sceptical. Through his studies of the politics of the internet, he believes the West has put too much hope into using the web as an instrument of democratic change. Repressive regimes have been able to develop their own powerful presences on the web and could be using it much more cleverly and stealthily than we originally thought. But what about the recent protests? Surely that shows the role of social networks are a force for good. Charles asked Morozov if he's still sceptical, even after those significant internet milestones in world political history.
I was never skeptical about the power of new media and social media to mobilize protest. You can use, you know, Facebook and Twitter and any other tools to mobilize people to do something that they wouldn't do otherwise. The question is whether that actually happened in Tunisia is an open one, whether any of the same people would actually show up as angry as they were if there wasn't Twitter or Facebook. I probably assume that social media did help to mobilize some people. I also think that it did play an important role in terms of highlighting what was going on and then transmitting it to some of the global media like Al Jazeera. And many of the protesters who were shooting YouTube videos explicitly said, we know that those videos will be aired by Al Jazeera. So all of that definitely is happening. I mean, my point is that, you know, if you want to understand the importance of the internet in democratization, we have to look beyond just its impact on protest and mobilization. Because if you look at a country like Belarus, where I come from, you get protests once in 5 years. And what happens in between matters as much, if not more, than what happens during the protests. And Belarus actually is a very good example of how, you know, new media and technology and mobile phones can actually be used against activists. So now there are some reports that after the protests following the presidential elections on December 19th, the government may actually be asking mobile operators for any data that they have on their subscribers to track down everyone who was present in the public square where the protests were happening. If the protest in Tunisia didn't succeed, chances are Ben Ali would now be going through Facebook and Twitter messages and all the mobile networks trying to figure out who was it that actually tried to, you know, protest against him, as actually happened in Iran.
So might it be that if you don't get those protests, that actually it's all happening on the social media, that those sorts of things are actually being done, that the protest is a form of failure, and maybe the social media enables these things?
It surely does. I mean, to me, the biggest question is, particularly in the context of authoritarian states, is whether social media protest actually is followed up by real world protest. I don't want to see Belarusian young people who may not be supporting the government to get this illusion that they can just be campaigning virtually. You know, I want them to go and participate in real-world protests. I want them to take risks and, unfortunately, get beaten up by the police and thrown in jail rather than, you know, stick to the virtual arena where they do achieve modest success. But that also gives them, I think, often a false sense of their own self-importance. I mean, and the government's often actually happy to let them, you know, score these achievements online because many of them just do not translate into gains on the ground. Even in the case of Tunisia, you know, the more we learn, the more we see that, you know, it was the role that the generals played and that the military played and didn't play and that the internal splits within the Tunisian, you know, political elites played. So again, you know, we have to make sure to separate the purely virtual from, you know, the physical.
You were critical, I think, of Hillary Clinton's speech at the beginning of last year about the internet and the possibilities for the internet when she was basically telling China off over its hacking of Google. Yeah. What is your take on that now, given what's happened since then?
I think I was proven right. You know, I was proven right mostly by what happened to WikiLeaks. In part, I mean, my criticism mostly focused on the fact that, you know, America's foreign policy agenda of promoting internet freedom was completely disconnected from its own agenda of internet control in the domestic context. You know, if you look at the history of American government's involvement with cyberspace over the last 2 or 3 years, it has all been about cracking down on internet pirates. It has all been about building backdoors into software built by American companies. It has not been about internet freedom at all. It has all been about internet control. But also, you know, you have to understand that my criticism of that agenda, it doesn't so much stem from my criticism of particular policies that, you know, Hillary or State Department want to promote. It comes from lumping them together under this banner of internet freedom, which many governments, because of some actions by the State Department over the last 2 years, take to mean, you know, the continuation of George Bush's freedom agenda in cyberspace as opposed to the defense of the freedom of the internet that the State Department probably originally meant. And looking at what happened in Iran in 2009, when the State Department actually intervened into what Twitter was doing, and they did it very publicly, most governments who are not friendly with the U.S. government, of course, assumed that they will be the next venue for Twitter revolution. So what do they have to do? They have to crack down on the internet. They have to limit what bloggers can do. They have to get Google and Twitter out and replace them with domestic companies. So all of that created an environment, I think, in which the situation with internet freedom actually became worse simply because Washington decided to frame all of its concerns, you know, under this banner of internet freedom as opposed to, you know, something less political and maybe less ambiguous.
So that's quite difficult, though, isn't it, for governments? I mean, because it sounds like you're suggesting governments should basically take a hands-off approach to the internet and say, well, yeah, we've heard about it and we think it's nice.
I'm much more pragmatic here. I mean, first of all, the fact that Twitter wanted to conduct maintenance during the protest in Iran just reveals the short-sightedness and, you know, very myopic view of the situation by Silicon Valley. But, you know, sure, the State Department could have reached out to Twitter without making it public, you know? So what I'm really challenging is not the fact that they're standing up to defend the cyberspace, but that they're doing it in such a naive in a political manner with complete disregard for the history of U.S. foreign policy and the history of the U.S. engagement with the internet and the history of the U.S. domestic policy with regards to the internet, that it actually makes the situation much worse, both for the internet and for the United States' ability to achieve anything using new media as a tool. You know, and I just think they look like, you know, an elephant in this China store, which is really not aware of what's happening, behaving very apolitically and historically, and I think think it just hurts.
So if you sort of look forward 5 years, how would you expect US, you know, the open governments and the authoritarian ones, how do you think their approaches to the internet will differ in 5 years compared to how they are now?
It's a one-directional, you know, unidirectional concern that only applies to how the Chinese and the Iranians and the Russians perceive American companies. Mm. And here I think Washington can be much more nuanced and be aware that technology is political and its companies are perceived primarily as American companies, especially after what happened to WikiLeaks. What the State Department has gone wrong in the last few years was in just hiring too many technologists. You know, so sure, a lot of these people are knowledgeable about the latest innovation in Silicon Valley, but you cannot reasonably apply that innovation to China if you know nothing about the likely response that China is going to have to, you know, American foreign policy.
So do you think it's going to be a sort of one-way process that the authoritarian states will get worn down by the openness of the internet?
No, actually, I think, you know, they have, if you look at the last 2 decades, the authoritarian states have adapted themselves to the internet, I think, in ways that no one has actually expected. China's solution was to build the Great Firewall of China. Now, it may be that they need to rewarm the Great Firewall of China and make sure that, you know, there are fewer people who are censored, but the people who are censored are really the ones who are most likely to overthrow the government. What we'll see is the rise of customized censorship, where, you know, the systems making the decision of what to censor and what not to censor actually learn from your profiles on social networking sites, and they know whom you're connected to, and they know what kind of news you read, and based on that, they make the decision whether to censor or not. So that, you know, investment bankers who only read Bloomberg and who, you know, only are connected to other investment bankers in China will be able to browse anything they want. And if you are a human rights activist connected to other human rights activists who reads, you know, New York Review of Books, you would only be able to browse the government-created internet. These authoritarian governments do need the web to grow economically. And I think it will actually be Western technologists that will supply them with this customization technology, because it's the same technology that is driving advertising. It's all getting customized and it's all getting configured based on your previous search history, your friends. You know, that's what drives Google and Facebook.
Evgeny Morozov with Charles, and The Net Delusion, How Not to Liberate the World, is out now. Okay, next on Tech Weekly, it's this week's news.
Apple's chief executive Steve Jobs has announced he's taken another period of medical leave. Jobs, who survived a rare form of pancreatic cancer and had a liver transplant, has said he'll stay chief executive, but Apple's share price dropped by 10% after the announcement. Goldman Sachs has been forced to withdraw its plans for a Facebook investment scheme in the US that had valued the firm at $50 billion. Strict financial regulations prevent banks from advertising such schemes, but the deal had been widely covered. Goldman had looked to raise $1.5 billion through the scheme, but had received orders for $7 billion. Facebook, meanwhile, was forced to reverse a decision to release users' addresses and mobile numbers through its developer API. Among widespread concern about the risk of data being used by rogue applications, Facebook has conceded better permissions need to be introduced for users. And Nokia is closing down its free, bundled Comes With Music store in 27 of the 33 markets where it has been available since it launched in 2008. Subsequently rebranded Ovi Music Unlimited, Nokia blamed low subscriber numbers, but will keep the service running in 6 emerging markets where users pay for downloads.
Thank you very much, and of course there's more news all week at guardian.co.uk/tech. It's often said that the next revolution on the net will be when Africa and the Middle East become connected. Millions more users coming online mean new markets for business and new voices adding to the global conversation. So what's the situation in India, a country which is well developed in some areas and has a small but significant number of young people online? What could be the future of the web there? And what are the concerns of the people who are online now? In the first of a series of interviews from India, Alex has spoken to Nikhil Parwa from business site Medianama.com. She began by asking him for an overview of the digital sector.
The digital sector in India is fairly small. It's difficult to, with a sweeping statement, define the entire space. But internet businesses aren't very profitable. There aren't many interesting businesses that we've seen here which have been developed in India for India. Most of the websites that we've seen in India are replicas of successful international businesses. For example, with the Groupon success story in the US, in the last 1 year we've seen about 7 or 8 Groupon clones in India. About 2 years ago there were several social networks that were similar to Facebook, and about a year before that there were, I think, about 20 odd YouTube clones in India. Most of these businesses die out because there is no compelling proposition for the Indian user, and frankly the Facebook for India is Facebook, the YouTube for India is YouTube.
Why do you think people jump on this bandwagon, and do you think it's more so here than elsewhere in the world?
Well, that's not to say that there haven't been unique and interesting businesses built out of here, but it's often a route to raising funding. People believe that if they do businesses which are similar to international businesses, then international venture capitalists will come and invest in them here. And we've seen quite a few of those businesses get funded because that's an attractive mandate that comes from the global office of that VC. And guess what? They shut down eventually. So how many of these businesses have we seen scale? Very, very few. The most successful internet company in India is one called Naukri.com. Naukri means job. It's similar to Monster. But what they've done is that they're mostly an offline business. They've put about 1,000 people on the street selling packages for classifieds to several businesses in India. So in India, an online-only business is unable to scale. Google's probably the only one that's managed to do that. Yahoo is still, from what I know, hasn't been profitable here for a while. But a hybrid model is what's worked in India.
Why do you think that is?
People weren't very comfortable paying online. That switch to being a digital native, it's now taking place. So they're more comfortable putting a face to a name. So that human interface is still necessary in India, and especially in sales. If you don't have feet on the street, it's very difficult to scale a business.
Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, who is investing in what? What types of things are Indian VCs investing in?
There are very few angel investments being or even seed investments being done by VCs in India. Quite a few of them have been investing in businesses that are already mature in order to scale them towards an IPO. Investments in early stage have been limited to about 2 or 3 VC funds. The one disturbing trend that I've seen is that this is almost always a very close-knit circle. VCs who are friends with certain other people, and they'll invest in their friend's company. I don't think there is enough scoping of the market or enough confidence in the broader market, in the young entrepreneurs. It's almost always a situation where you find mature businesses or very experienced professionals whose ventures take funding. And that's worrying because if you see globally, the best ideas have come from people who've not come in with a significant amount of experience or with a lot of baggage.
Why is that? Is that because there is starting to become a kind of developer community? Are there specific regions, like for example in Mumbai or in Delhi or Bangalore and Hyderabad?
So there are communities in Bangalore. Bangalore is possibly got the most number of startups in India. There are also communities in areas around Delhi, in Gurgaon and Noida.
Do you see any innovation, anything specifically Indian that's coming out of the Indian scene?
There hasn't been much specifically Indian in terms of an innovation. I think the one company I can think of is a company called TringMe from Bangalore. That created a product called Voice PSP, which allows people to create applications using VoIP. But India is more about using international business models and customizing them to India.
What do you see needs to happen within the Indian digital scene in order for it to become a leader rather than a follower?
First up, I think that there need to be several more startups, and there needs to be funding available for these ideas, because the thing is that you can replicate all the international ideas you want, but the more people try to differentiate, the more chances of there being an Indian technology success story. I don't think there's enough of that happening. The other thing is that Indian businesses tend not to focus on the product, and what a lot of the Indian internet businesses are doing is that they are spending on Google AdWords and then trying to upsell that to advertisers. That's sort of a trading game doesn't get you very far, because then it's just who spends the most and then who gives the advertiser the lowest cost of entry. And that's a downward spiral that's impacted a lot of internet businesses in India.
And what do you see as the future of the Indian internet space?
Everyone's talking about the mobile internet space in India and the mobile space because the internet space itself hasn't taken off. So that's the next big hope. Unfortunately, I don't think we've seen enough products out there to help bring people onto the internet in India. You need people to be able to market their products, and that's where social media is becoming increasingly important right now, because the cost of acquisition of customers is much lower on social media, and good products become viral more quickly on social media. So social media is going to be a very, very important component. I'm quite curious to see how the mobile social networking space is going to evolve, because right now there are several estimates, but you know, the guess is that there are about 50 million internet users in India. And as of a couple of months ago, it was estimated that there were about 450 million mobile users in India. So there's an opportunity to bring all of those guys online. But the biggest challenge right now, and not enough people are focusing on that, is around language. There are several Indian languages. I think there are about 23 official languages. And there are thousands and thousands of dialects. You know, you can't read websites in Indian languages on most mobile phones here. So are you going to be restricted to the about 100 million English-speaking population in the country? I guess so. There is a lot of hype, but there won't be growth without language.
So do you think that there is any reason for, say, British companies to come to India, to set up shop in India?
The more the companies in India, the more the competition, the more the innovation. But they should remember that they'll have to adapt to Indian business models, for one, and two, they'll have to adapt to the Indian consumer. Perhaps if they come with no preconceived notions about the market, they'll be able to do what Indian companies haven't been able to do, which is adapt.
Nikhil Parwa with Alex, and you can check out his site at medianama.com. That's media, NAMA.com. That's all for this week's, though. Thanks to Charles and to Alex. She'll be back next week when she's finished volleyballing, when we'll be hearing from Joel Spolsky of Stack Overflow, the site which helps you get quick answers to programming questions. A Quora for coders, if you like. Until then, get in touch with us via Facebook or Twitter. All the links are at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. I'm Jemima Kish. The producer was Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.